Right, as is customary, we have a sort of engaging and interesting intro to the podcast.
Ooh.
I've forgotten to bring one.
Hang
on a sec. Let me just... Let's see. Last issue, last fortnight was podcast season 2, episode 5. So this must be episode 2... No, this must be season 2, episode 6. I can't even get that right, and it's written down in front of me.
That's not a good start, is it?
Well, things can only get better. Welcome to Linux Voice Podcast, Season 2, Episode 6. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Graham Morrison.
I'm Mike Saunders.
And I'm Ben Everard.
And in this fun-packed podcast, we have many news. We have a brains to speak. We have a mixture of singular and plurals. We have voice of the... Vocalise your neurons.
Vocalise your masses.
We don't have any printed notes this time,
no,
do we?
No, we don't. This is awful.
That's because we're a paper-free office. We respect the environment.
Hang on, we're also an office-free office.
Yeah. And money-free office.
Yeah, so news, finds of the fortnight, vocalise your neurons.
There's one neuron to be vocalised.
Yeah, excellent. Where should we start from?
Let's start... Well, we could start by saying issue 2 is out. Because issue 2 of Linux Voice, the magazine, went on sale just last Thursday in the UK, and it's going to be the first on sale in the US newsstand, which we're really pleased about. It's going to take a bit of time, as the first issue did, to make its way around the rest of the globe. Although we have been told by our distributor that subscribers, print subscribers, should have to wait no longer than 10 working days to get their copies.
Yes.
So you must let us know if it's longer than that, and we'll do our best to get copies out to you.
Yeah, so that should really be by the end of next week at the latest. People should be getting their copies of issue 2, even if you live in a far-flung corner of the globe.
It's the one with Grace Hopper on the cover.
Yes.
Yes.
I feel a little bit of pride for that.
Yeah, me too.
It looks so good.
It looks really good on that Google Plus page, because you have to crop it to a certain shape. So it's just her head with free software needs you. Closely cropped.
That's great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
The cover feature isn't necessarily about Grace Hopper, though there is a Grace Hopper tutorial in there and her work with UNIVAC. It's just that the cover feature is all about coding and...
how easy it is to code.
How easy it is to code on lots of different things. How accessible it is and how many different platforms. Learning now. And just a picture of some code.
Or a penguin.
Or, you know, how do you photograph electrons? You know, we don't have one of those electron microscope things yet.
But can they actually photograph electrons anyway?
They use electrons to photograph.
Yeah, so you can't fire electrons at electrons, I think. Anyway.
Why can't you do that, Mike? Why are you so rubbish?
Yeah, I'm working on it.
They'd have the same charge, so they wouldn't they just sort of do something?
Yes, we're all physicists here.
I used to teach physics, so I can't remember.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, Ben.
How many lives have you had?
Ben is a character invented by Virginia Woolf. He moves through the ages. Or Forrest Gump, either or.
There's just a painting of me getting older that I keep locked away.
Actually, you are looking a bit younger than last time.
Yeah.
Ben's looking great, listeners.
Yeah.
So where are we continuing from?
It's news.
News.
Oh, it's news. Excellent.
News. All right, the first item up on the news agenda. Microsoft Office has been released for Linux. This isn't an April Fool's, but it's not what you might think. The Linux in question is Android, so you still can't run it on your Linux desktop, although you probably could if you used
Android x86.
Or the Android emulator,
yeah.
With the Android SDK. But
you might as well use Wine.
Yeah, frankly, you might as well use Wine. I've just downloaded it, had a bit of a play. It's a really sort of stripped-down version of Office, as you might expect. It's not a replacement for proper Office. So you use LibreOffice, really, if you want to do that, and you can get away with the functionality. It's quite interesting, actually, to see sort of some of the comments on the Google Play Store. And one of the sort of themes coming through was, this doesn't work with this Office file, this docx file, you know, this
really?
And yeah, and people using the same, just use, you know, the various other Office suites that you can get for Android because they work better.
You would think if there was one thing they were going to get right, you know.
And this is really interesting considering it comes just a couple of weeks after Microsoft of saying, the doc files are open because all these different programs can use them. If even Microsoft can't write software that follows their standards. That really shows it's not an open standard.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just probably such a nightmare, you know, the amount of cruft that has been built up in the doc format over the years.
So this is the release has probably turned into excellent, inadvertently, excellent ammunition for the next European court case when they say, no, it's all open, honestly.
Yeah.
I wonder if it changes, I mean, if it signifies Microsoft's changing attitude to, well, I suppose its own platform, because in the past it would have just created a walled garden around its own Windows Mobile or whatever it's using and not, and get people to use it for its business.
Hang on a second. This is for Android?
Yes.
Is there a Microsoft Office out for iPhone?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, so, right.
At the same time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
I mean, because let's be honest, it's handy on a phone to check stuff, make quick operations. No one's really going to be doing any desktop work, any...
Ooh. Ooh.
There's somebody at the door.
Who could it be?
What's the beer?
Beer's arrived. Beer's arrived. Beer's arrived. Everybody, beer has arrived.
Beer.
What kind of beer?
I've got some all Woodford's Wherry.
Oh, so proto beer.
Yeah. And I got some of the, there's a new Young's American IPA.
Oh, brilliant.
So 6.5%, incredibly hoppy is what it's supposed to be. Yeah. And I've got some Belgian beer that needs bottling tomorrow. But it's going to take another 6 weeks, 2 months. So we've got to try and forget about it. So if you ever come back here, you know, it's not in the garage.
Keep it secret. Yeah. Well, the reason that I asked about whether it was on iOS or not is that it would make sense to release it only on Android so that more people buy Android and less people buy iOS.
Well, because Microsoft gets a cut from Android sales as well.
Yeah, exactly. So to crowd out a competitor from the market, and then that also makes sense as a reason. That may also make sense as a reason not to release it on desktop Linux.
The message was, Degville, woo, distracting IRC noises, woo.
Brilliant.
Yes, it worked, still void.
I think the way Microsoft has looked at it is Office is a huge thing for them, isn't it? Office and Windows are their big cash cows. And if they want people to still be using Office, they've got to bite the bullets and release it for other platforms. They can't just keep saying, oh, well, if you want to use mobile Office on the go, you've got to buy a Windows phone or what they call them, slate tablets and stuff.
I've always felt that Office was the thing that made people keep buying Windows.
Mm. Yes.
That is the one bit of software that if it's completely tied in and you use the macros, you use your Active Directory, everything, it's very hard to get out of that in your organization. Whereas Windows itself, if you could run Office on Linux regularly, then it would be migrating away from Windows would be a much simpler proposition. And then you could break it down and then slowly move over to...
That's why LibreOffice deserves all the support it can get, because when people realize that they don't actually need it, then you know they're free to run whatever platform they want.
Yeah, yeah. And I really thought they wouldn't do this and try and use exactly the same principle, and not necessarily the desktop. Not in the phone space, because I think it's a nice thing. It's not really that important.
Yeah,
phone.
Yeah.
But with more and more fancy executives using tablets. Mm. I thought they'd try and use the same thing to force their Surface Pros and et cetera into the boardroom and filter down from there.
I wonder if this is partly to do with the new CEO. I mean, I know he's not been in charge for that long, and obviously this has been in development for longer than that. But maybe, I have no idea, but maybe Ballmer would never have done this. And this is a sort of an indication of the change at Microsoft, the change in attitude.
Perhaps it's an acknowledgement that they know they've already lost the tablet battle.
Mm.
And it's not embarrassing for the new chap to say so.
No, and it's the right thing to do.
It makes a lot of sense.
They should have done it a long time ago.
If that's, I mean, Office is their most lucrative product, so it makes sense to protect it, to embrace and extend.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, moving on. More Microsoft news. There's a lot of Microsoft news for a little
Microsoft
podcast.
Voice.
Yes.
Brought to you.
We should sell some advertising.
Microsoft has released the source code for DOS versions 1.1 and 2.0 and Word for Windows version 1.1a.
Yeah, I've got to admit, being a hacker of a 16-bit assembly language operating system, I did download the source code.
For it's DOS. Not open source, is it?
No, well, that very much depends on your definition of open source.
Is it shared source?
What would RMS say?
RMS would say...
It doesn't respect my freedom.
In what way does it not respect your freedom, Richard?
I don't know. Does Emacs run on it?
Probably.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of restrictions of what you can do. You can't release modified versions, basically, is right. The main one. So it's not under any sort of OSI approved license. It's
well, that's rubbish.
Yeah, why did they do it?
Why? Yeah, why bother?
It might be like 20, 30 years since DOS 2, MS-DOS 2.
Yeah, about that.
Yeah.
Maybe this is also an anti-Apple move. It's to stop Apple copying DOS and using it on the next MacBook Pro.
That's true. Yeah.
Now, I think, to be honest, it's to try and get some of the goodwill that Linux gets from the Raspberry Pi and that sort of thing in education, saying, you know, it's an open, you can look at how it works, and you can say, look, yeah, you can see how ours worked 30 years ago.
Yeah, there's not much to be learned from that. But yeah, the original early versions of DOS were little more than a sort of wrapper around the BIOS calls anyway. You know, it's interesting that, what do you call an operating system? You know, okay, could understand a file system, but a lot of programs at that time were just interacting directly with the hardware and the BIOS anyway. So it was in some ways a glorified launcher. And with a few file management commands.
Yeah. And as I say, it's been released to the Computer History Museum. It's not released to like a GitHub or anything like that. It's not designed to be built on. It's there for interest.
Right. It's Computer History Museum in America. Swindon.
No, not in Swindon. It's probably not. It's a Museum of Computing History or something like that.
Right.
If I'd done more research, I'd...
The People's Popular Front of Computing.
Yes. If there's not a museum called that, there should be.
Well, there is, of course, free DOS as well, isn't there? I think that's a GPL DOS clone, which is actually under reasonably active development.
Yeah, and obviously this could cause problems for them if they were to look at it because of the licensing it's under to sort of try and implement some of its features. I don't know if it is missing any features, but they could potentially, if Microsoft wanted to go that way, get in trouble for it.
Now, I've looked at the source code, and if I implement a new feature in macOS, Microsoft can sue me and say, well, I got the inspiration from their code. So that's why they've done it. Right, I'm leaving the country. Okay.
It's all a grand ploy to take down macOS.
Absolutely.
Mike, you have already left the country.
Oh, yeah, that's good. I'll have to leave that one as well.
Except not today. No, we didn't actually mention that Mike is here with us.
Mike's here.
Mike is not here via internet. We could pinch him and push him and all kinds of things.
True, yeah. I feel the pain for real now.
Okay, more news. The new CEO of Mozilla, his name.
I wondered what you were going to say then.
Because what do your notes say?
Mozilla CEO, Brendan Eich.
Any relation to David Icke?
I haven't put his name into ancestry.co.uk. I couldn't possibly comment. Well, let's start with what he's famous for, and it's his contributions to JavaScript. And
didn't he invent JavaScript?
Yeah. Well, that's quite a contribution.
That's pretty epic.
And, you know, he's been around browsers since before there were really browsers, and, you know, huge technical chops, you know, and on that side of things, incredibly good person to have. On the negative side of things, and which is what's caused a lot of fuel around his appointment, really. In 2008, he donated some money to a campaign against gay marriage in California.
Proposition 8, I think.
Proposition 8, and obviously this has quite rightly upset a lot of people. And especially given Mozilla's sort of open, free culture, they're almost a figurehead of freedom, not just, you know, in Linux, but in sort of computing world in general. There's a lot about the way the corporate structure works that
is
open, not just the software. And
it isn't, in fact, it's increasingly not the software, it's the openness. It's the fact that you have to trust, you know, what they're trying to do and what they're trying to achieve.
Exactly. Brendan said that he wants, this culture he wants to create or continue is this open culture where people respect everyone's belief. And I don't know. It's a difficult situation because on the one hand, it's being used as this sort of sledgehammer to beat Firefox in there.
He hasn't. Has he made any more recent comments on
the interview I saw this morning? Said he wanted to create an open thing where everyone's beliefs could be accepted.
Because 2008 was quite a long time ago.
It was.
Yeah. People are allowed to change their opinion.
Yeah, Mr. Obama has changed his opinion on the subject, for instance. I think a lot of people have sort of gone a bit mad about it, you know, overreacting, saying, "Well, this, you know, is completely disgusting and stuff like that." But I'm not really going anywhere with this, and I don't really want to say anything that could just cause.
Matthew Garrett had some sensible words that he wrote.
What did he say?
He said something like, "A leadership position isn't just a technical position where you're an administrator," and if Matthew said that he has the technical chops to administrate a small Republican organization, but he would be the wrong choice of leader because he is not a Republican by, you know, US standards. He's quite left wing. Mm. So somebody who doesn't necessarily share the open and inclusive love for all people of Firefox, of Mozilla, might not be the best choice of leader.
Mm.
Even though he might be a very excellent, very capable communicator and administrator and leader in all those other areas.
But
I'm paraphrasing.
That's certainly valid, but it's also wrong to extrapolate that because he doesn't believe in gay marriage, he doesn't believe in equality and freedom. A lot of people like to bring the two together, but it's not quite as
cut and dry as that.
I mean, there certainly, it does show that some...
I think it's the difference between there are plenty of people who see marriage in its traditional man and woman form, and a lot of people believe that. Fair enough, that's up to them. But I think it's the fact that he's given money to stop.
I'm not terribly keen on marriage.
Really? Didn't you get married recently?
Yeah, well, a couple of years ago. Yeah,
but it was a long time ago. People can change their minds. Hasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's what's got a lot of sort of Mozilla contributors and people a bit riled, is the fact that he actually contributed money to stop this happening. Not just his personal opinion, that's up to him, fine. If it's his belief, fair enough. But yeah,
same token, it's his personal money. That also is up to him.
Well, it is, but it's sort of very actively campaigning against something instead of just having your own belief, having your own view of something.
I think it would be useful if he clarified his position right now, you know, so that he could explain how he feels and why he feels that way, or if he's changed his mind, then people can stop worrying about it.
Any coincidence that Fred Phelps has just died?
And the uneasy political territory of the Lennox Rice podcast.
Coming up, an 8-page feature on whether or not gay marriage is right.
Let's move on to something completely controversial now, something that no one has any strong opinions about. Gnome 3.
No, I don't believe in Gnome 3. I would pay £1,000 for Gnome 3 to be wiped off the face of the planet.
There is no Gnome 3 in Iran.
Gnome 3.12 is out. It's obviously the latest version. It comes along with a few extra bits and bobs. The high DPI thing has been a big feature for many people. Apparently it looks all fancy and whatnot on fancy computers. Not having a fancy computer myself, I don't know.
I think there's a Dell XPS 13 lying around it.
Yeah, I brought it down anyway. I should have tried it for the podcast. Mm. But in fact, I was just showing Mike the Dell XPS 13 last night, and I kept going on about how, you know, Linux desktops really need to face up to the challenge of these high-resolution screens and how we're going to deal with it. So I am really intrigued to find out how it works. In fact, we should review GNOME from that perspective with maybe the Dell XPS. It's got a 1920 by 1080 display.
Mm. Yeah,
it'd be so nice to have. I mean, I've just grown so used to seeing Linux on like ye olde laptops.
Yeah,
it'd be great to see it. You know, something new, brand spanking, shiny, running on some top hardware.
Yeah, well, I had it at OzCon last year when you and I both went out to Portland. It was the Dell XPS 13. It was a great machine.
now comes with wireless, I believe, as well.
Yeah, yeah, that one from last year didn't work. The Wi-Fi didn't work.
What was that, a Linux driver issue? Or
well, yeah, so Dell did correct the problem, but yeah, they hadn't properly researched. I think with each iteration of how they build these laptops, they change all the time, and it's obviously principally made for Windows. So something changed in the hardware that there wasn't a proper Linux driver for it. In fact, there was a driver, but it didn't work very well. So the solution was to swap out the mini PCI board inside the machine.
Oh, you could change it?
Yeah, you can change the mini PCI boards in most laptops.
Oh.
Probably not that one.
No, probably not. Probably not my Inspiron 800 from 1994.
You haven't got the RMS Lee mode.
No, I don't have the his tiny Chinese netbook.
Well done, GNOME team.
Yeah. Right. Next item is, it's almost legally possible to rip CDs in the UK. Because I've got a big stack of CDs. They're 10, 15 years I've been waiting to rip them.
Yes, it's crazy, isn't it? Is it, how long is it? Is it 15 years ago that the first MP3 players came out?
Something like that, yeah.
So I must admit, I ripped my CDs a long time ago.
Ooh. What's a CD?
Can I admit those things?
What's a CD, Grandad?
It's like a small laser
disc. Daddy-o.
This is completely off topic, but I'm going into it because it made me feel old. I was teaching some kids how to use Scratch as part of a sort of conference thing.
Oh, you're the best, Ben.
Yeah, and we were there, save it, and someone was doing something. I was like, oh, just save your work. And he looked around, I was like, oh, just click on the floppy disk. And he just looked at me. And I was like, yeah, the square thing with the circle in the middle.
Oh.
And it's like, I was like, I haven't used a floppy disk since after he was born. How sad is that?
That's become the international symbol for save.
No one knows what it is.
I'm just launching LibreOffice now to see if it still has a floppy disk icon you click for save. People must find that really strange.
There's not a good alternative. Some have like a downwards arrow, but sometimes that means download.
Yeah, that's not very clear. Or scroll down or what.
Yeah, I don't know what a better icon is, even though that's wildly out of date.
The icon for email is still an envelope or a stamp or a
yeah, that's true. So maybe it'll stick. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But people at least still do post things in real envelopes, whereas a floppy disk
and it makes sense. I mean, envelopes are what I get all my junk mail in, and so is email.
Yeah.
So apparently, this change in the UK copyright law isn't going to apply for DVDs with copy protection.
It applies for CDs and eBooks, but not DVDs. Well, there's some sort of wiggle room in that if you can show that the copy protection is excessive. Then excessively restrictive, I think the legal term is, then you can copy it. Ooh. I don't know how you show that it's excessively restrictive.
Yeah, the DVD doesn't fit into my laptop without a DVD drive.
Yeah. I don't know if it beats you because it doesn't agree with your views.
Yeah.
So what laws have we all broken by ripping CDs 15 years ago?
Copyright.
Oh, okay.
I have never ripped a CD.
Honestly?
Yes. I break no crime here.
I remember years ago, I ripped some CDs on my work laptop, and it was Windows, and I just, ripped CDs. Did it all into, what was it, Windows Media format?
WMA or something.
Fail.
I know, massive fail.
Yeah, my sister had a load of, in fact, it was the most important thing for her when she moved to using Linux full time, and I had to, at least iTunes no longer has DRM in the files that it copies across or even that you buy. So it was just a case of finding the AAC files and converting them. But yeah.
Do you want to know something else that doesn't have DRM?
What's that?
Yes. That's a digital subscription to Linux Voice.
It doesn't have DRM.
No DRM, no.
Oh, but surely it comes in a proprietary format.
I don't know.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
PDF is an open format.
PDF is an open format, everybody, and there's no DRM.
And we were giving people a free extra byte at the beginning of their PDFs recently, weren't we?
Yes, we were giving people an extra byte for free.
That's how generous we are, only with Linux Voice.
Yeah, courtesy of PHP.
Courtesy of a new line character in a PHP script. It was a weird one to figure out, that.
Yeah. Stack Overflow to the rescue, though.
What did you search? Random stuff at the beginning of my files.
I think it pretty much was that. Random character at the start of. Yeah. Download. I've completely lost where I am. Yeah, so you can rip CDs and ebooks, but not DVDs. You must own the original, and if you sell it, you must, or give it away, you must destroy the copy.
I do still have all my CDs. I must admit, I never get them out.
Simon, if I've got a CD and I've ripped it and I give you the CD, I have to destroy my files.
If you give it to me to keep, I think.
Right.
That makes sense. Yeah, I mean, that does make sense.
Yeah. Do I have to use like the shred command, not the small RM, just to make sure they're really gone forever?
Yeah, why not?
If that even works on SSD drives.
Yeah. That's a good point, actually. It's impossible to prove something's fully deleted off an SSD.
I guess they don't want you using it because you no longer own it. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what is deleting. Like when the government went into The Guardian and demanded that they delete their data by, was it, sawing their laptops in half?
Yeah, with them saying, we have copies in the States. Yeah. You know?
This is the most pointless thing ever.
Yeah, but that did, I mean, they could trap everyone at the airport when they brought the copies back over and beat them with sticks for 7 hours.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Without access to lawyers.
Yeah.
So go freedoms.
Are you being tough on terrorism? Soft on terrorism, sorry.
I'm being soft on terrorism.
Get out.
Actually, I think I'm being hard on terrorism. The terrorist here is the United States, the United Kingdom government.
Freudian slip.
Yeah.
political episode of Linux Voice.
They're terrorizing The Guardian. Making them destroy their laptops.
Right. So, you got any plans to travel soon, Ben?
I travelled.
Sorry, Sydney.
I travelled with my laptop a few weeks ago, and I don't usually carry it with travel. But I was really hoping I'd get pulled over and the section they were like, turn on your laptop, so I'd turn it on. And the bootloader's broken. Actually, the desktop manager's broken, so you just get a blank screen. And they'll be like, what's the password? I can give them the password, but you won't find a way of typing it in. Yeah, I don't believe I've got any legal obligation to tell you how to unscrew up my laptop.
No, you could charge £35 an hour.
Yeah.
I actually got my bag searched yesterday at Munich Airport because I had my Raspberry Pi with me. So they pulled it on and they're like, what's this test? Well, it's a small credit card size computer. Oh, it doesn't matter. Yeah. They saw the geekiness exuding out of me and they just, yeah, whatever.
Okay, on to crowdfunding. Crowdfunding, an awesome way of raising money to start awesome new projects. Mm. Just don't do what Oculus Rift did and then sell out to Facebook and disappoint.
If you want people to love you.
If you want people to love you.
So what is the price of love?
How much was it?
Is it a billion?
It was a few billion, wasn't it?
It was a few billion. The people who supported Oculus Rift, which is a virtual reality headset, the people who supported it on Kickstarter, I think are pretty miffed because they thought, people who back Linux Voice, they're part of a project, they're part of a community, building a product together that's going to be awesome. And then a giant sort of bit sinister, massive advertising company.
$2 billion.
$2 billion. So Facebook comes and buys it, you know, and a lot of people don't like Facebook. And people think, well, why did I put the money in the first place if they've just sold it to a giant company?
Especially as one of the sort of selling points was, it was a buy gamers for gamers.
Yeah, and they were doing a really good job of that.
Yeah.
And they'd involved a lot of, they sent out hundreds, thousands of developers' kits.
Really.
Yeah. There was Linux support. The APIs were supposed to be really good. Everybody loved working with them and their units. So, I mean, I know a lot has been said already, and the internet has been on fire with the whole purchase, so I suppose it's not worth going over it too much, but I was so excited by the Oculus Rift. You know, I remember, like lots of people have said in the 90s, playing those arcade virtual reality machines, and I love them. I thought, they were so laggy. They were running off Amiga 2000s with some 286 or 386 bolted on for the rendering. And just the potential for the future just seemed immense. And then, you know, watching videos of people playing Elite Dangerous with their Oculus Rift headsets and looking down to the left to see the little BBC keyboard embedded in the heads-up display. It's just, you know, just so excited. And it might not necessarily change.
Well, there are sort of two viewpoints about this. Either Firefox, either Facebook has bought Oculus Rift in order to integrate it into its seamless advertising, but all this usual nonsense. Man, yeah. Or Zuckerberg does realize that Facebook's days are ultimately numbered. You know, kids are moving on to InstaChat and TwitGram, all these other services I have no idea about. But so maybe he's thinking,
I'm an old man.
I am indeed. But maybe he's thinking, well, you know, I want to branch out into other things. And he might leave it alone and just give them money and say, well, go on making cool stuff. I hope that's the case, but I suspect it's not. I suspect it's another way to eventually put adverts in people's faces, and literally in people's faces, in the case of the Rift.
Yeah. But, you know, I suppose Farm Girl will look all right. And
Shame. Well, isn't Valve supposed to be working on their own? Well,
apparently they were working on their own. And
Sony are.
Yeah.
Project Morpheus or whatever.
Oh, yes, they are. They announced that recently.
Sweet.
Yeah.
And that's cool. I mean, I've got a PlayStation. That's great. But it's not as good as, it's, you know, plugging Linux into an Oculus Rift. And, you know, just imagine the kind of cool KD desktop I could have.
Especially, it would have been really, because a lot, especially in games, a lot of the peripherals have stayed close to one platform. Close to one platform, which I think is really limited, like the Kinect and the Xbox, the Wii Remote thing, etc., etc. It'd have been really cool to have a cross-platform thing, where it just give developers so many more options to create something cool, rather than, you know, having this for that and this for that and breaking it all up. But
oh well, we've still got the Virtual Boy anyway.
Yeah,
those were the days. Red LEDs.
We're only 44 minutes in. Come on.
Right. There's been a new kernel release.
Wow.
Ooh, the Pi kernel 3.14.
Ah, excellent.
Support for more ARM system on a chips and MIPS.
System on a chips?
Yes, system on a chips.
Not systems on a chip.
System
on a chip sounds like something from a bad takeaway restaurant.
on chip.
It's like Grand Prix. Like, is it? How do you?
Which bits pluralized? Grand prizes. Is that passers by or passerbys? That one always gets me as well.
45 minutes.
That sounds great. Anyone use?
Yes. More ARM stuff, actually. Raspberry Pi. The Broadcom data stuff, information about the Video Core 4 was released back February time. And Raspberry Pi says, we've got a big, big bag of money for the first person to get Quake running using this documentation.
Quake 3, wasn't it?
Quake 3, yes. And someone's done it, and they now have a big bag of money.
Good for them.
Yes.
I like money.
Yeah, I would imagine they do too.
I haven't tried it.
Money's good.
Money.
No, I haven't tried it for a while. it's going to take like 12 hours to rebuild the kernel on a Raspberry Pi, isn't it? It's already in there. It's on GitHub or on there.
Yeah, although if you're using a Linux box, cross-compiling should be pretty straightforward.
If you can set it up, yes. We should do some easy-to-follow instructions on setting up cross-compiling, because it is very useful.
The one thing that I saw really easy is because you can use distCC across different architectures.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you do that and you start it on the Pi, it'll automatically set up the cross-compiling, apparently.
Oh, cool.
So that's not the same thing.
Well, it basically is cross-compiling, but it's just using distCC to manage it.
So most of the processing will be offloaded onto your more powerful boxes.
Exactly.
And the Pi sits controlling it all.
Yeah.
As the coordinator.
I say that. I've never tried it. I just believe that it can work.
The last time I did it, it was just difficult tracking down all of the ARM tools that needed to be installed and creating the kind of the Chroot environment needed to get it to work.
I mean,
but that, I guess, distCC doesn't. It's just actually offloading the...
Exactly.
As long as you've got the right libraries installed, it all goes back to the Pi when it's finished.
Yeah. I mean, Google have done a fantastic job of making that work really well with the Android compilation. It all comes together and you just click build and it builds it and runs it in an ARM emulator. Happy times. But...
Excellent. And it's great that there's a... You know, thanks to Broadcom and thanks to whoever did the driver. I mean, that's going to make things great on the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a fully packaged, ready to run driver yet.
But it will, yeah.
It starts to be brought into the sort of driver stack, etc. More work to be done. But yeah, I mean, it's obviously a big step there. And just one last item of news. There's a new book on the best-selling books on Amazon, programming books.
Wow.
Yes.
Is it about assembly language?
It's not about assembly language.
Is it about macOS?
It's not about macOS.
It's about cooking.
It's not about cooking. It's about programming Python on the Raspberry Pi.
Wow.
What a name.
Yes. That's a great name for a book.
We should review it next issue and give it so many stars.
If we've got to find somebody objective enough to be able to give it the correct score.
What about Nick?
Yeah.
I'll do the score. It's all right.
You just want to have the last look at the PDF before it gets to the print, is it?
Yeah.
Well done, Ben. It does look awesome. It really does.
Weren't you like one of the top sellers on Amazon for a few hours?
A few days.
A few days,
yeah. I was the number one programming book. And I think it reached a peak at number 206 overall across all Amazon books.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. It's now like 3,000.
Right, okay.
You know.
Are you rich now then? Are you the only person now who's actually got money out of all of us?
Literally pennies.
Literally pennies.
No, I mean, it's years before I get any money from it.
Okay.
Such is the life of an author.
Said Ben, his sleeve covered in candle wax. Coughing daintily into a silk handkerchief as he expires in his garret.
And that's the news.
Discoveries of the fortnight.
I've discovered some things.
Finds of the fortnight.
I've found some things. Can I go first, please?
Please.
Yes. Now then, Finds of the Fortnight is quickly becoming the, or for me anyway, the section in which other people find things and I claim credit for them. So
it's like Reddit.
So in this grand tradition, I would like to steal a Find of the Fortnight from Phil the Sheep. Mm. Hello, Phil the Sheep. Thank you for your awesome thing that you found. And this is a business card that is powered by an Arduino.
What?
So it's a really, really tiny. It's not. It's a business. It's like it's an Arduino machine thing with inputs. And some fellas put a working version of Tetris in there. But it's the size of a business card.
What about the thickness?
It's really small.
Yeah. Because the smallest the 80 mega chips AVRs are, you know, maybe a centimetre by a centimetre and only a mil or two high.
Have you got a picture there on your Turbo Linux laptop, Andrew?
Yes. Let me pick it up and turn it around and show it to you.
Oh,
there.
That is pretty cool.
Amazing, eh?
Yeah.
Did you want to comment on that find?
No, it looks awesome. I can see the picture.
Yeah.
And we need business cards.
We do.
Yeah.
I want tasteful Garamond on duck egg blue.
I want a game of Tron in mine.
Off-white, Cillian Rail.
We could make them punch cards.
Comic Sans for Mike. My second find is that I've got a new telly.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, my old telly was really small and everything was really black if you looked at it from an angle. You had to be standing exactly straight on to see anything, which made it not very useful as a telly.
Can you not have positioned mirrors around the room?
I could have done. That would have been taking them off the bedroom ceiling.
Yeah.
I can't be bothered with that. That's the spare room. That's where you're staying. Ah, yeah. So it's
the cameras.
It's a new big. It's a new big telly. I've got a great big telly. Like at the start of Trainspotting, when he talks about how great it is to have a big telly and sit stuffing junk food into your mouth.
Are you living that life?
I am. I'm living the dream. And it runs Linux.
Ooh,
because it's a smart telly.
Wow.
By LG, which is the company that made my Nexus 5 phone.
Right.
Which also runs Linux in the shape of Android.
How did you find out your TV's running Linux as a kernel, a penguin when you boot up?
No, I found out it runs Linux because I tried to install Silverlight on the browser.
Okay.
So I could watch rugby on BT Sport, and it directed me to the Moonlight page. And there's no way to install it because there's no password.
Somebody still uses Silverlight. I knew that Ryanair's website still did.
I know. Quite a lot of streaming movies.
It's unbelievable.
Why?
DRM.
I thought, What? Oh, okay.
So anyway, so on the LG forums, you know, there's loads of people saying it looks like a version of Sousa, from what I've gathered.
Well, really? It actually looks like...
It doesn't look like anything. I mean, like from the comments that people left. Mm. You know, people have said, oh, is there any way to install Silverlight? No, we have no plans to help you install Moonlight, sorry.
Mm.
Which is a bit poor.
Are you going to get Herd running on it?
I'm going to triple boot it with macOS and the Herd.
TV edition. Watch ASCII art versions of your favourite sports.
And TeleOS.
I've always wanted to try the M-Player ASCII.
It's codec. Really good, yeah. Is we it? Watched some of the World Cup on it one year, didn't we?
Do you remember back in that certain old company we used to work for? Yeah, you could telnet in to someone's server and watch the football in ASCII art.
Nice.
So it got around certain company rules of watching high-definition football streams on your monitor.
Of course, that's SSH.
Yeah. But you could just about make out what was going on if you had a small terminal font and massively upsized your terminal window. So you know, you'd then have a resolution of about 200 blocks by 50, 80 blocks or something.
There's a Telnet server running with an ASCII art version of Star Wars.
Yeah, that's been around a while. You can just log in at any point.
And those are my finds.
Lovely.
Hmm.
Mine and Phil's.
Yeah, yes.
You look like you're going to go next, Mike.
Do I?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or shall I go? I've got an audio-related discovery.
I'll go and put the kettle on.
Well, Andrew's just talked about TV, so before we go back into multimedia, I'll talk about my discovery find, which is a text editor that some people might have heard of called Vim.
You got really excited then when you said it.
I've actually become a massive Vim zealot.
Vim or NeoVim?
Well, NeoVim's all right. So Vim, really, I've had an epiphany. I've had an experience. I hope you all...
I shared in that experience with you last night when you were showing me all these commands while we were drinking beer.
Oh, I remember that.
For about 45 minutes.
Was it really? Yeah.
It's just incredible. You could do all these remarkable things.
Drunk.
Yeah. By just typing stuff into the command line. And what you type into the command doesn't appear on the screen. It's just like magic.
I've used VI and Vim on and off over the years, but I never really got into it. I never really understood why it is the way it is. I remember reading an interview by Bill Joy, the original VI creator back in the day, saying, well, I was working on a 300 baud teletype modem, and so everything had to be concise. But because of a certain feature I'm writing for a certain magazine, I had a proper go at Vim, and I followed the Vim tutor, which is quite useful for getting the hang of basic commands. But I was still like, well, why do people still use it? And I found, I think it was on Stack Overflow, an absolutely brilliant explanation about looking at Vim like a language. You use it as a language to manipulate text. So like the example I showed you last night, you're in a paragraph of text.
You started speaking Vim. And it reminded me of you speaking German.
Really? Yeah. Well, maybe there's some similarities there. But yeah, so you're in a paragraph and you want to delete the paragraph. And instead of grabbing the mouse or pressing shift and arrow keys, you just type DAP, delete around paragraph, delete all text around, including
the paragraph. Translates as well in real time, like an interpreter. DAP.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you're inside some quote marks, like in a HTML tag, DI quote mark, delete inside the quote marks. You can move text around like this. You can manipulate text as these text objects. You are speaking a language with an action and with a verb and an emotion.
And emotion.
Oh. Not emotion. Yeah.
So you can have the dative case.
You don't have Debbie or Daft, thankfully, to deal with. I get it now. It's still taking time. But I've had the epiphany.
Can I add a cavernous echo effect to this part?
Yeah. And you make me float at the table.
My issue with Vim is back when I was at uni, did quite a bit of programming, and I got into Vim. I was like, oh, this is really awesome. Yeah, you can do all this wonderful stuff. Oh, it's so powerful. I don't know why anyone uses anything else. Blah, blah, blah. Then I didn't program for a little while. And I started again, so I picked up Vim. and I've forgotten everything. So I was like, oh, no, I've forgotten how to use Vim. So I went through it all, used all the tutorial. I remember it. Mm. And I said, yeah, it's amazing, powerful. Why would anything? Then I didn't program for a little while, and then I forgot. And then I needed to program again. And I was like, screw this. I'm going to use Nano. Yeah, if you're using it day in and day out, it's incredibly powerful, really useful. But if you don't use it enough, you just forget.
You have to get all these things right into your head. There's a famous graph for learning curve for Vim, and it's just straight up to maximum on the first day, and then it's a flat line. It's like, you know, there isn't a learning curve. You learn all these amazing stuff, and then it's useful for ages. But there's no real all bit by bit here and there.
I just get horribly confused when I open up a text editor and I'm typing and nothing comes up. Yeah. And suddenly I hit A. I'm in Vim.
Yeah. But the mode system gets people as well. But the trick I've seen is always command mode should be your default mode. So you only insert text when you really explicitly need to. And as soon as you finish, hit escape. So
why else would you use a text editor?
I can see I'm only going to cause more arguments here.
Can we just cut this entire section out? Because it's really rubbish.
The one thing that I'm using another text editing, actually I could really use Vim now, is when you're in the command mode and you press dot to redo the last time
redo
you did
action,
it.
Yeah.
And there's a few times where I've been in another text editor, so actually I'd really like to have to do that now.
Yeah.
I like the immediacy of search. Just pressing /  and searching through stuff. I use that all the time. Mm. And I like appending text to the end of a line, but really that's about as much as I know.
Yep, that's my find.
Cool.
Shall I go now?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know.
Mine's really quick because I've spoken for too much already on this podcast, I think. I've got two jokes. These are my discoveries. My first joke. A programmer's having a baby, and a friend asks her, boy or girl? And she says, true.
Oh, wow.
The second one's better. Right, three programmers walk into a bar, and the barman says, so do you all want a beer? And the first programmer says, first one goes, I don't know. Second one goes, I don't know. And the third one goes, yes.
I don't get that. It's like exclusive or
because the first one would only be able to say no, because he doesn't know whether the other two want one or not.
Now he can say yes.
I'm just too thick. That leaves my discoveries. Right, well, I won't go on too much about the audio-related discovery, but there's a fantastic piece of software that's been released. It's commercial and it's quite expensive, but it's called Bitwig Studio, and there's a Linux version of this. If you're into audio software at all, you'll know that Ableton Live is the market leader in lots of different ways, and lots of artists use it, and DJs in particular. It's a fantastic piece of software. Bitwig Studio is a very similar application, and the fact that there's a Linux version of such a brilliant original and new product is just fantastic.
I'm not an audio geek or anything, but Ableton Live, that's for, you do stuff for live playing rather than like editing recordings, don't you?
Not really, no. Oh. I mean, yes, the live in Ableton Live is because it's suitable for performance.
Yeah.
The innovation in live, if you look at the way that this is working, like things being recorded across timelines like that, that's the way that DAWs worked, audio workstation software worked for 20 years, 30 years since Steinberg or whatever in the 80s. Live has got that arrangement view, but also created a clip view where you basically create loops on top of one another, and then you can launch clips and reconstruct pieces of music from the clips. That's why it's perfect for DJing, but it's also perfect for song construction because so much stuff is made out of loops. And those loops can be MIDI and they can be audio, and then you can pile on effects and use synthesizers. So that part is the live part, and it does that without any kind of dropouts, but you can also use that as a way of making music. So I mean, I used Ableton Live as a way of making music, and lots of other people do. And Bitwig Studio is the only other DAW really with a clip view like that. And there's a Linux version.
Awesome.
It's been like 2 or 3 years as a beta.
I've only just got DAW is. You mean
digital audio workstation.
I keep thinking of DAWs.
My other discovery is that Frank Oz, he was the voice of Miss Piggy.
In The Muppets?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also the voice of Yoda. I never knew that. And then my other discovery is the Conservative Party are going to give tax benefits to games studios in the UK if they can fit a certain criteria or a cultural test.
Wow.
As the Conservative Party call it.
I love these.
It's insane. This is my discovery.
That citizenship
I can't believe
test.
They can get away with it. I can they get it? Anyway, I should have. So a video game may be certified as a British video game under section 1217CB of the Act only if it passes the following cultural test.
Okay.
Now, the test, there's lots of stuff in the test, but it includes things like up to 16 points shall be awarded in respect of the content of the video game as follows. 4 points depending on the percentage of the video game that is set in the following locations. 75% if it's set in the UK or other EEA states. 66% if set again in the UK or another EEA state or set in an undetermined location.
EEA is the European Economic Area.
Yeah.
EU plus Switzerland and Norway, I think.
So I guess that legally they've got to put this.
Yeah.
But it's insane that, firstly, this part is insane that they have to separate the UK from the EEA anyway. But this, I should have marked out the bits that are the most funny. If there are only three characters depicted in the video game, 4 points if two or three of them are from the United Kingdom or another EEA state, or from an undetermined location, or if only one of them is from the United Kingdom or another EEA state, or from an undetermined location, 2 points if that character is the first or second lead. 1 point if that character is the third lead.
So stuff like Frontier, for instance, which is not set in the European Economic Area, does that fail?
Well, as long as they put like the U in colour and etc., then that probably makes them British.
That is completely
that's utter nonsense.
Locations, main characters, scripts, all that, the kind of weird narrative fictional part of how you make a game, they're basically the
but
same
not the actual ensure, making
no,
of the
no.
game
no there's a small part actually at the bottom which is down to personnel. If your composer is English or British then or from the United Kingdom then that's 4 points as well.
Do you reckon we could classify Linux Voice as a text-based game?
With a bit of modification.
Yeah,
but what I just find is that's such a weird way of doing something. Just to, in some kind of weird cultural cancerous way.
Yeah, that's something's been classified there by someone who doesn't understand it.
Is it just that they want to give a tax break to games companies and they think by adding this bit, it'll stop people voting for UKIP?
Sounds like somebody's trying to justify their job by coming up with the most obscure, twisted... So you're going to make a video game where you're killing aliens and stuff. But, it's a good idea if you pretend that it's in Britain. We'll give you a tax break.
Oh, it's a brilliant idea for a Tory-friendly video game. Badger killer. You've got an illegal shotgun. You're roaming the countryside. Brilliant.
4 points may be awarded in respect of the contribution of the video game to the promotion, development and enhancement of British culture.
Or EEA culture.
Yeah, hey, just say British. They must have looked at
Level 2 of Badger Killer could be like the students are protesting.
The sequel is Fox Hunter versus Badger Killer.
Up to 4 points depending on the percentage of the original dialogue that is recorded in the English language or in a recognised regional or minority language. Anyway.
What, of the EEA?
Yeah, I guess of the EEA.
Latin and
even if you chose the UK, I think you've got a pretty good palette of languages to choose from. Yeah. So yes, that was my other discovery. That's the UK games, UK video games cultural test for tax relief and games development. And they were our discoveries, finds.
So now that we're 95% of the way through the podcast, it's time for the halfway reminder. Still to come, there's Vocalize Your Neurons and Voice of the Masses.
Which we'll probably get through in about 5 minutes. A neuron was emailed to me for vocalization from Rob Adonato. And he's got a pretty cool neuron, I would say. He says, Blender is holding a bold, risky crowdfunding drive at this time. And succeed,
oh, I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, and succeed or fail, please help it succeed. I just wanted to point out for just a moment how simply incredible it is that right now, just about anywhere on the planet, just about anybody with a 10-year-old computer can get started in 3D sculpting and animation. Those that dismiss the user experience are like those who get upset that they can't fly a plane the first time they sit in a cockpit. The investment is time, and that is true of learning the tools and techniques for any artistic endeavor. And not only can they get started, but they can do pretty amazing stuff. Recent Blender short films, like the pair of Caminandes Llama escapades, show that the software is really only limited by time and dedication and creativity put in. The creative tools available for free on the Linux platform are incredible. I think that's a good point, Rob Adonato. We tend to forget about a lot of this, but the fact that it is freedom around the world that anybody can create thanks to
Blender is incredible.
Blender, GIMP, Audacity. You don't have to pay money to be creative.
Although I do think Blender's UI is difficult.
Well, he's saying, you know, invest the time. Maybe it's like we said about Vim. It's completely ridiculous at the start. Thanks, Rob. If anybody else wants their neurons to be vocalized for the next podcast, email me, mike@linuxvoice.com. So over to you, Chris.
Now it's time for Voice of the Masses. Thanks, Chris.
Yes.
We asked, this is a hastily abridged version of Voice of the Masses with bits crudely hacked out of it. So if you made a fantastically erudite post and we don't mention it, we're sorry, it's just that we're very pushed for time. However, the posts are all there on linuxvoice.com. Mm. So go and have a look. There is there's a studied and thoughtful debate on there, as always. Thanks for keeping this corner of the internet so sane.
Our readers are the best. Yeah.
So, Voice of the Masses, X, Mir, Wayland, do you care? Subhead, no, it does not matter. Alejandro says, as a user, no, it does not matter.
That's it.
Mitch just read Wayland and or Mir as KDE/GNOME. Does it matter? No. Bit more depth from Spike102. Mir versus Wayland is just another canonical / Red Hat bitch fest gone viral, but it is so last year. I can't believe you people are even talking about it. Surface Flinger won this battle for an X.org replacement way back in 2009. I think that's something to do with Android, isn't it? Surface Flinger?
Yeah.
They're like...
It's a display manager.
Display engine, right, yeah.
The latest bitch fest that everyone's onto is Mark Shuttleworth versus John Masters on ARM64 ACPI versus flattened device tree. Get with the program, Linux Voice, and try to stay current.
There's our next voice of the masters.
Is it ARM64 ACPI versus flattened device tree?
It just rolls off the tongue.
Good Lord. And Matthew S. has responded to that by saying, the X and Wayland comparisons and benefits are still a current topic of interest. As for staying current and following trends, the Linux and free open software movements are all about having options, not just following trends.
Like breakfast cereal.
As Coco Chanel said, fashions come and go, style remains. She also liked Cocoa Pops because they make the milk go chocolatey.
Cocoa Pops are named after?
Which is, no, that's why she's called Coco Chanel. Little known fact there.
Really?
Yeah.
It isn't April the 1st, you know.
Oh, I hate April Fool's Day.
I used to like it. I don't know what's happened this year.
You're not five anymore. Paul says, I'm an elderly user. Simplicity and out-of-the-box functionality matters. Wayland versus Mir doesn't to me, as long as it works. Paul, I'm in my late 20s, and simplicity and out-of-the-box functionality is all that matters to me as well.
You've been in your late 20s for a long time, haven't you?
I'm in my very late 20s. So loads of people say that it doesn't matter. Starfire IT says, it matters to someone, but that someone is not me.
Alma matters to someone, somewhere. Oh, yeah.
Is that Morrissey?
That is Morrissey.
Oh,
yeah.
Good. Yes, safe. Of course it matters. Of course we should care, but not for the obvious reasons. That would be technical benefits of one platform over another. Divergent mutation is necessary for evolution when going from one tried, tested, stable platform to a revolutionary one. A period of experimentation, trying different and, if necessarily, divergent approaches before borrowing, blah, 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 is key. The final platform is immaterial. The fact that there is this natural selection process is vital.
That's a good post.
It is a good post, one of many good posts. And someone else has said that there's a good idea, there's a good logic behind using something other than X because of the more permissive license, which lets it be adopted by different kinds of hardware. And that's I think that's a pretty good summary, to be honest.
Wow.
I don't know. What do you three think? Have we got time to hear what you three think?
Oh, we have got a few minutes.
Okay, we've got the luxury of
It's 8:30. The reason why we've got to go is we've actually got to go out and have a meal with the person who bought the Leap meal on the Indiegogo campaign. Mm.
The guy that spent £1,337 to have a meal with us.
So this may be the last Linux Voice podcast. Not many joking.
It's Mark Zuckerberg. I think a lot of people are making it more of an issue than it necessarily has to be. There was those blog posts about, does the display server matter? And every single argument I saw in that could equally have been made to say, oh, let's not bother with BSD because Linux is better. Or let's not bother with, something. You know, it does benefit having these divergent approaches. I mean, it's the same with browsers, you know. Why bother with Chrome when we've got Firefox? Well, there is some benefit to having more than one platform. I think there is some weight on Canonical's shoulders to make sure they're compatible with Wayland rather than expecting people to be compatible with them because they came along and stirred the pot, which didn't necessarily have to be stirred. But on the whole, as long as... I was thinking about this today. I think one of the biggest advantages of this... One of the problems with X is we had it for so long that it became so ingrained into the free software system, the Linux stack, that it's really, really hard to extract it from it and change it with something else. By having two solutions, by having Mir and Wayland, hopefully it'll force not necessarily a written down standard, but like an ad hoc standard. And 5 years down the time, when new technology comes out and there's better ideas, it would be much easier to implement them because we won't have one archaic system that has just sort of mutated and wrapped its tentacles around everything.
That's an interesting point, like XDG and stuff, the free desktop.org stuff. There are standards have emerged because we've got all these different desktop environments, and that might be frustrating to people, but it's brought about some standards.
Exactly.
I understand why Canonical is... Well, I think the reason is for Canonical and Mir. They want to be... The only way they see as having, this is my opinion, of having any control over the way their phones work and their tablets work and their desktops work is if they actually control the way that the desktops are rendered. That's probably the only way they see that they can make things look the way they want it to, and it simplifies the way that they develop their operating systems. I have no problem with that at all. I'm glad that we've got Wayland and X Wayland for the rest of us so that there's a choice, and also it provides competition for the two of them, and maybe the two will converge at some point in the future, or at least there's some feature parity between the two. You know, if Mir has a great feature that gets ported over to Wayland. I used to think it was a bad thing. I used to think that it was bad that there was a lot of wasted effort creating two projects with similar goals in the same way that Unity and GNOME split. They both had similar kind of UI design ideas. Maybe if there were three, I wouldn't feel quite so happy about the situation. But at the moment, Mir's yet to deliver as well. I mean, that's another thing. Wayland, I keep meaning to try it, but Wayland, you can get up and running right now.
With Rebecca Black,
you can get it up and running, but it's not in a everyday state yet.
And also, Wayland, I mean, did you see that other post that NVIDIA developers, the proprietary developers, are working on Wayland support?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's going to be such a massive boon. that kind of thing. And if Wayland's got this direct connection to the hardware drivers, it's going to run so well.
Especially as we've already seen Intel push back on MIR.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, that Canonical would know that that's what would happen.
Yeah.
You know? And I think what changed my opinion on Canonical is just the systemd thing. Because I, you know, I could, the way that they decided to go back, they didn't decide, the way that the community decided on systemd over Upstart. And I found Mark Shuttleworth's post on that to be pretty humble and good. So I kind of feel reassured that they're doing MIR for their own reasons. It's a business. They're entitled to do it.
Yeah. And I think they came off unnecessarily bad in the Upstart thing, because you hear about it so many times. Oh, you know, this is the MIR Wayland thing. It's just like Upstart when there was already systemd. No, there wasn't. Upstart was first, and then systemd came along.
Yeah.
And they still got...
And I think, as you mentioned when we brought it up in the podcast, there were some very good reasons for both. Yeah. You know, and the fact that the Debian guys and the Debian people had discussed so strongly about the pros and cons of each before deciding on systemd. So the fact that there are two is a good thing, I think, in this instance.
I'm not entirely sure either of them are ever actually going to deliver, though, to be honest. I suspect we'll be sitting here in 4 years' time saying, and the next release of Fedora is going to have Wayland, and the next release of Ubuntu is going to have MIR. I think it might end up like The Herd.
One day. And the old projects could be as awesome as The Herd.
And on that bomb.
Is that it then?
That sounds like the end of the podcast.
That's it. It's only 1 hour and 15, 20 minutes in.
That's mega long.
Well, there is bits to cut there.
There's a few bits.
It's a long podcast, but that is, you know, what more would you expect from the team that produces a magazine that's 114 pages long?
And it's been 3 weeks as well. Really sorry for the delay. We thought it was worth waiting for Mike to get into the country.
It's like 1.5 podcasts.
Security.
Yeah.
The next podcast will be missing me as well. So rewind, listen to my beautiful face again.
So make the most of your appearance here in episode 6. And
I wish I'd said something clever in there. Oh, well, it's always the way.
Like three programmers walked into a bar.
can't wait for the next jokes. There could be a regular section of the podcast. Ben's programmer jokes.
Right, that's it, isn't it?
Yep.
Let's call it a day. Bye-bye,
everyone.
Cheers, everyone.
Okay,
bye.